Welcome back to Shattering Miss. This article that we were considering about Fatah on their homepage, posting a picture of a pile of skulls with their flag fluttering above them, and the skulls identified with by Stars of David on them. This article says Fatah is considered the more moderate of the two major Palestinian political parties. Hamas, which controls Gaza, has engaged in repeated battles with Israel in recent years. Fatah controls the West Bank. It's kind of interesting. I said that, you know, there's only one political party in the West Bank, and that's true. It's just Fatah. Fatah does not allow Hamas to engage in politics in the West Bank. And in Gaza, Hamas doesn't allow Fatah to play. So in both areas, you have dictatorial one-party regimes. And this then says in parentheses, Fatah may not be moderate, but relative to Hamas, it is restrained, says Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute in his congressional testimony in 2013. Well, may not be moderate. Fatah is a terrorist organization. It's not the least bit moderate, and it's Islam is fundamentalist. But it is more restrained than Hamas because it plays more political games than Hamas does. The image was posted as part of an online celebration of Fatah's 50th anniversary. The group was founded on January 1, 1965, carrying out its first major attack against Israel at that time. It was founded on a terrorist attack. Ehud Yari of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy called the latest image typical of their ongoing propaganda. So here's Fatah saying, yeah, posted on their Facebook site, posted in celebration of their 50th year anniversary of their first terrorist attack against Israel. And here it is, typical of their ongoing propaganda. And they said, oh, no, no, we didn't do it. No, no, no. It's not the first time the Fatah images have sparked anger after three Israeli teens were kidnapped and killed last year. The Facebook page for Fatah, the Palestinian Authority's main party, had a number of cartoons, including one showing the three teenagers as Jewish rats wearing yarmulkes caught on a fishing line. Yes, Islam is despicable. Hello, Kirk. How are you this fine day?
Good morning. I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. Oh, doing fine. It's supposed to be a nice day here. We've had a lot of what we would consider cold. I've got to be careful because I think it's minus 400 in Minnesota, where Scott is managing the controls of this program. Yeah. So when it dips down into the 50s and low 60s and we moan that it's cold here, Scott is likely to mock us, maybe even mute us.
I just told you that you don't know the definition of cold. That's all I said when you were talking about it.
Yeah. Now, I have been to Minnesota many times in both winter and during the 4th of July, which is the summer season, and can attest that when they talk about cold, Minnesota is a special cold because it the wind howls. It's like being in Chicago in the middle of the winter. And I've been in minus 70 wind chill in Chicago. When you walk outside and any part of your body, like your face that isn't covered, the wind just absolutely is like driving nails into your skin. It's a pretty miserable experience. But
you know, it can freeze you and your nose can fall off. No, I'm serious. You can come in, you can freeze you and you got to cool it down slowly or warm it up slowly.
Yeah, I've seen, just for giggles, we've gone out in Minnesota and taken a coffee that we've just brewed. And you take a cup of coffee outside and you throw the coffee up into the air. It freezes before it comes down. You know it's cold when that happens.
Yeah, I did a workshop in Brainerd, but that was in the summertime, and I was kind of chilly then. I mean, they told me stories. They said, don't you want to come back, you know, during the wintertime, and we can do snow scenes outdoors? And I said, are you crazy?
No. I mean, nice people in Minnesota. It's a lovely place during the what we used to call fly season or mosquito season. around the 4th of July when they have their summertime. It is really quite nice, although it's hot and humid and the bugs are as big as birds.
I was going to say, there's only two seasons up here, man. It's cold and it's humid. That's it. There's no in-between. It's cold or it's humid.
Yeah,
it's pretty, though.
It is pretty.
In the summertime.
Yeah, it's pretty in the summertime. I would agree. I lived there one summer working for a company. I don't even think it exists anymore, in Anoka, Minnesota, which is just down the road from Coon Rapids, Minnesota. And my best friend during the years that I was engaged as a manufacturer's rep owns and runs a factory in Minnesota called Nordicware, the front pan people, their gourmet baking manufacturer. And so I've spent a lot of time in Minnesota. I like the people, like visiting there, don't care much for the weather. Anyway, that's not why you call, my guess is, Kirk.
No, I haven't had a chance really to call in much over the last couple of weeks because I've been working, but I've managed to listen a little bit. And you had a conversation with Glenn, also one of our favorite people, and there were some points I thought were, they kind of stimulated me and some things I thought I'd throw my two cents in when y'all were talking about Chabuk. And he asked a rather interesting question. He said, well, why don't the Jews or the Yehudim, why didn't they embrace Chabuk and throw it in the face of Christians, either in early years or through the continuing years, to argue against Christianity? And
That's a good question.
So I'm sitting here leaning in, and I said, well, why didn't they do that? And I'm thinking, you know, and first of all, I came up with about three good points, I thought. The Jews, you know, number one, don't care what the Christians do and what they think or embrace. They're not interested. I mean, they are involved with their lifestyle and their religion, and they certainly don't care whether Christians do anything as long as they leave them alone.
That's partly true, not completely true.
No.
And let me share what I mean with you.
Mm-hmm.
It would be completely true as it would pertain to this particular prophecy, and that is because, who did Paul address? Who did he beguile?
Well, he was after the Gentiles or the Goyim.
Correct. So Paul did not focus on, he did not prevail with. In fact, he was wholly incompetent and incapable of fooling a Jew, because the only way Pauline doctrine works is you have to be completely ignorant of the Torah. If you have any knowledge of the Torah, Paul's letters won't fool you. So Paul's focused entirely on Gentiles. It is true that rabbinical Jews do not care which Gentiles believe.
Mm-hmm.
They have no interest. Now, rabbinical Jews care a lot about a Jew, a racial Jew who accepts Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
They care a lot about that. And they actually have a very aggressive policy towards harassing any Jew who accepts Christianity. But as a matter of fact, during the time of Rabbi Akiba, Jews hunted down and killed, mutilated ethnic Jews, Yehudim, Israelites, who accepted the Messiah. And so they have a real interest in them if they're ethnic Jews. But in the case of Paul, you would be completely right. So as it relates to this particular prophecy, which is about Paul, and it's specifically his audience, which would be Gentiles, as announced in the prophecy, they would care less.
Yeah.
So you're right. There would be no reason for them. You know, Judaism never had an interest in debunking Christianity, particularly as, you know, Christianity got its foothold and grew as a result of the transformation of Imperial Rome to Roman Catholicism.
Yeah.
The Jews hated
the
Imperial Rome, and they hated Imperial Roman Catholicism, just as Imperial Rome, because Imperial Rome hunted them down and killed them, just as the Roman Catholic Church hunted Jews down, tortured them, and killed them. And so they would have no interest in them.
Yeah.
And so that would be, your point is valid because of Paul. That's the first one.
they didn't try to evangelize the world either. I mean, they're not everywhere. When people become Yehudim, part of the family, not Yehudim, you have to be born there, but I mean to become a Israeli or Israelite, you would come to them. I mean, you do that only because you came into proximity to them and read and studied and said, accept the covenant, agreement, the covenant agreement. So,
yeah, it's true.
They didn't go all over the place saying, like a Christian does, I've got to change, you know, I've got to evangelize the world now.
No, the Torah only tells Israelites that if a person comes to them and is desirous of being part of the covenant, that they are to be included. But it does not never ask them to go out to the Gentiles, to go out to other nations and evangelize them. That's so you're right. Jews were never interested in spreading their religion, nor ever interested in competing against Christianity. So it wouldn't be part of their mindset to try to debunk Pauline Christianity because it didn't pertain to their people.
And then I thought as I was listening to y'all, one of the other reasons that they wouldn't really embrace Chabuk would be if you get in a debate on Chabuk, then you have to really bring up a lot of the Torah, and that is the Torah, or the prophet, and part of it. And then your malfeasance, how are you going to fight something if you're rabbinical using the Torah? You can only use your arguments, which is not the Torah.
Yeah, since this begins by Yahweh saying, upon my requirements and my responsibilities, I'm going to stand, how can you think that I'm going to change, and therefore I'm going to pay attention to what he has to say about me? How would you differentiate that from rabbinical Judaism?
You can't. There's no advantage to you to go out there and do it. So Chabuk becomes a book that nobody, either they mistranslate, which they did, because I have a 26th edition, the word, with all these different Bible translations, and Habakkuk, which is misnamed to begin with, Habakkuk doesn't sound anything like the original. You've got the same thing. All you do is expose your own malfeasance when you debate on that.
Yeah, the individual, the masculine singular individual with a soul is named Sheol after the place in every Bible translation. And to do so means you're not paying attention to what the text says. It's not even possible. We'll be back with Kirk and Shattering Mist after the break. On the question as to why rabbinical Jews haven't over the years deployed the condemnation of Paul and therefore Christianity, found in Chabuk 1 and 2, against the religion. And your first point is that they're not in competition. They're not in competition with the religion. They would have no interest in proving the religion false, because the Pauline Christianity, as the prophecy announces, is focused on Gentiles, not on Jews, and Jews really don't care what Gentiles believe. So they would have no interest in doing so. Haven't had any interest in doing so, don't have any interest in doing so, and have always despised the Roman Catholic Church and also Imperial Rome, which is where all of this took root. And your second was that there is no way for them to effectively criticize Christianity based upon this prophecy, because they are guilty of the same thing. A different audience, but guilty of exactly the same thing. Their Talmud twists and corrupts the Torah
brutally,
and it obfuscates Yahweh's responsibilities and the requirements for participation in the covenant. So they tear themselves up. As a matter of fact, in this regard, what did Paul claim to be before he became the founder of the Christian religion?
He was Big Shot Rabbi, according to him.
According to him, Big Shot Rabbi. trained at the feet of the biggest of the big shot rabbis, Gamaliel. So, Pauline doctrine is written. Paul's letters are written very much like the Talmud. I mean, they're arguments against the Torah, just as the Talmud is rabbinical arguments against the Torah.
Yeah. God says I say.
Yeah, God says I say. So you're right. For them to use that as the argument against Pauline Christianity, first, they have no interest in assailing Pauline Christianity because it doesn't pertain to them. And number two, one side of the sword would, yes, cut Pauline Christianity off at the knees, but the other side of the sword is going to cut off both of their hands and head. So it's probably not a good move.
No. And I was as guilty as all the rest of the Christians because I didn't pay any attention to names. I knew all these names meant something, but I didn't study it hard. I asked the question, Sheol, different pointing, but the same word in the ancient language.
Right.
Place of question, a place of separation.
Right.
What prophet in Israel, what representative of Yahweh would have a name like that? You right away you say, well, his name is questioned. Well, maybe I ought to question him.
Right.
So obviously that's why you'd want to change it.
And by the way, that rendering of question him from Shaul, you could also have he questions until you read the Chabaouk prophecy, because the Chabaouk prophecy, twice in it, Yahweh says, why don't they question him? I mean, he's called him out by name as Shaul, which is Paul's given name. And then Yahweh says, why don't they question him?
Yeah.
So he's identifying the meaning of the name. But you're right. There was one famous Israelite named Shaul, question him. And that was the man that the Israelites chose to be their king against Yahweh's encouragement. He says, you don't want that. This is a bad idea. You get a king like all the Gentile countries surrounding you, and he's going to oppress you. He's going to lead you astray. He's going to lead you into wars. You're going to lose those wars. He's going to accumulate and steal your wealth. Don't do it. It's a bad idea. And that guy's name was Shaul.
Shaul, right?
Right.
So, I mean, you compare that to a Yael Conan or a Shimon Kevish or a Matin Yah or anybody you want.
Or a Yasha Yah or a Hosha or a Malachi or a Zachariah. And you have all these names that have profound insights. So Yisrael, I mean, you're right. All of the names tell us something that's very important about the individual and their allegiance.
But Christians been paying attention to that change. Don't change a dot. Don't change a tittle.
By the way, how many of the of these individuals, like even Moshe, the name means to draw out,
and that
worked with Yahweh to draw the children of Israel out of the most religious and political and militaristic place on earth, the crucible of Egypt. All of these names have meaning. How many of them changed their name?
Not a single one. Till King James came along. Used to be Hines.
Yeah, that's right. But none of them changed their names.
No.
Why do you think that Paul changed his name? Why did Shaul choose to be Paulus? We'll consider that when we return. So, Kirk, I have a question for you. Paul, whose name was Shaul, most certainly read this prophecy when he was in rabbinical school. And we know that he read it because he made reference to it three times, citing it twice. He misquoted it in two of his letters. The first is in the first letter to the Galatians, and the second is in his letter to the Romans. He took a passage from Chabaouk 2 and twisted it to form the basis, the literal. I mean, this is really the fulcrum of Pauline doctrine is based upon a misquotation from Chabaouk 2. So he clearly read it, and he read the portion that's in immediate proximity to the citation of his name as the person doing this. And he also has a reference to it when he went to the disciples and, you know, and was questioning them and trying to ascertain whether or not he was running in vain.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a direct reference in this prophecy that if you pay attention to the prophecy, he'll run away.
Yeah.
And so that's the third reference to it. So there's no question he was aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was aware that it condemned an individual with his name, that he absolutely knew that it condemned him.
Yeah.
Now,
freaky, huh?
You think that was why he changed? You think it's why he changed his name?
Well, it's odd to me that he calls him lowly and little, which Paulus is lowly and little in Latin.
Yeah, that's on the what's called the Sermon on the Mount, the instruction on the Mount. It's specifically said that the one who will attempt to perpetrate the lie that Yosha came to annul the Torah, that he did away with the Torah, the one that who will promote that lie will be called lowly and little, and the one that who will advance the idea that the Torah has been annulled will be called lowly and little by those in heaven. And Paul chose a name that is lowly and little.
Now, I understand why he would call him a Roman name, because he moved in Roman circles and he was after the Gentiles. So he was separating himself from any Jewish name, Hebrew name.
Hebrew name, yeah.
But why he would... A man as vain as him and as... thought of so much of himself, I'm surprised he didn't use a grandiose name of some kind, but he chose Paulus, and there you have it. So.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Of course, it's interesting also that Yosha, being able to know the future, knew that he would choose that name, meaning lowly and little. But I suspect that he changed his name specifically, because Yahweh's messengers are never changed their names. Their names were always such that they depicted their commitment, their allegiance, their perspective, their purpose. And so he is the only one that changes his name, but in his case, he wasn't one of Yahweh's spokespeople, so he changed his name for his purpose. You know, even Yosha will go as far as to say that I came in my father's name, which is what Yosha means. Christians, of course, don't know that because they changed his name to Jesus Christ. But Yosha, it was his actual name, and that is the father's name. It means Yahweh saves. I come in my father's name, and you do not accept me. And yet one will come in his own name, and you will accept. And Paul was the only one who actually came in his own name, who chose his own name and had an entirely different mantra.
But Christianity changes every name. Find one in the Christian Bible and tell me which one is true.
Jacob became James for the purpose of honoring the English king. Matanya means Yahweh gives, became, Yahweh's gift becomes Matthew, and Yahweh Kanan, which means Yahweh's merciful, becomes John, and Shimon, which means, he listens, became Peter. Rock, you know, the nickname became Petros, and then to Peter. You're right. Christianity changes all the names, and Christianity even changes the names of Yahweh's messengers. He gave Moshe got a Greek name, Moses, and Yashaya, which means salvation is from Yahweh, got a name that is Isaiah. And then you look at really everything. It's the only one that I'm aware that wasn't changed is Abraham.
Yeah.
You know, a combination of Ab and Rakam, and maybe they just figured that no one would figure it out.
No one cared.
That it means merciful Father.
Yeah. But I mean, that is so telling. I mean, you start out on in a tablet of stone, says don't change my name, and anything, every name associated with him at all gets changed. I mean, and you're supposed to be proud of that.
The most important name that Christians changed?
Yahweh.
Yeah, Yahweh. They replaced Yahweh with the Lord. Yeah. Well, if you're willing to change God's name.
Yeah, but I was curious about Shimon Kevish.
Right. You know, they changed the title of Messiah to Christ.
Yes.
They changed the name Yahusha to Jesus. Yeah, I guess you really couldn't. It's the, and if you're, somewhere along the way, you'd have to say, why did they change all the names? What problem did they have with the names? Because, well, in Hebrew, they all communicated something that, that was important, particularly Yahusha. If you don't change Yahusha's name, you can't have a religion. You can't have Christianity ceases to exist the moment you adhere to or accept his actual name. If you know that he is Yahusha, you can't have a Christian religion. It literally disintegrates at that very moment because it means that Yahweh is saving, which means there isn't a Trinity, which means there isn't a man didn't become the totality of God, which means that God didn't die for your sin. I mean, go all the way through it. It means that the Torah, prophets, and Psalms were not annulled because this is the author of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
If you don't change him to Lord and Master, then you can't step in the way and say, I represent him, and you owe the master all this stuff. I can't steal your stuff.
Yeah.
You know, if I don't turn him into a master, so, I mean, or a lord.
Yeah, the lord owns the lord.
I've got to make you a serf. Well, he owes you, and you ought to pay a portion of that back to him, because look at all the things he's done for you. Save your soul.
Yeah, you look at Theodosius, who was the is the Roman that actually established Roman Catholicism. He's also the one that established the feudal state of lord and serf, and imposed it on Roman Catholicism and its the territories that it controlled out of the fall of the Roman Empire. For 1,000 years after him, amongst the five most evil men who ever lived, in terms of influence, negative influence on the world. And, you know, he had his lord, and then he had his lords. And the lords were to be treated just as the lord, to be feared. They had the right to control, to own, to subject the masses to their tyranny.
But, you know, in my question then became, as I was thinking about all this, I'm asking myself, now, why? I understand why the priests are doing this. I understand why the preachers are doing this. I understand why the rabbis are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, there are some literate people around. They're going to read it, and they're going to come to a different conclusion. And then my answer to myself would be that, you know, the Catholics, which are the predominant part of Christianity, that's the big number, the Roman Catholics, and then maybe the second number, the Greek Orthodox, not the Greek Orthodox, but Orthodoxy.
Eastern Orthodox, which includes the Greek Orthodox, includes the Copts. I mean, all of Orthodox Christianity combined is the second head of Christendom.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and then, of course, we have a smaller group, which is the Protestants, and another one that most Americans and English Commonwealth countries are know most.
It's 90% Roman Catholicism, just with some slight tweaks from eliminating some of the worst of Roman Catholicism, but carrying a lot of the worst along with the Sunday worship, Christmas, Easter, the Trinity, sorts of things.
You coined the term, right? You said, you know, Catholic light, or Catholicism
Catholic light. Mm-hmm.
And that's true. But if you in what they study, you've got the Torah, of course, is replaced by the Talmud. The Catholics, they have their missal and their church canon, and on and on and on. And if you really look at how errant the Bibles are, and then all the letters of Paul. I mean, the Christians don't have a chance. I mean,
yeah, you know, when I look at this, Kirk, you know, I devoted a year of my life to writing the first version of Questioning Paul. Yeah, about 600 pages long, did not even reference Chabuk, not even a reference to it. Well, that's not true. When Paul misquoted Chabuk in his letters, I went back to Chabuk, the specific passage in Chabuk, and I translated it correctly and juxtaposed to Paul's errant rendering of it. So I did reference Chabuk in that regard. Mm-hmm. But I did not realize that all of Chabuk was a condemnation of Shaul and Pauline Christianity. Didn't realize it, even though, you know, I could read Hebrew, I could translate Hebrew, I knew that Paul used the prophet, and yet I didn't do it. And as you said, if you don't go to the Hebrew, there is no way you're going to recognize that this is a condemnation against Paul, the founder of the Christian religion. You have to go to the Hebrew to figure that out, because Shaul is rendered Sheol, and that's impossible in context, because everything in the prophecy is speaking of a lone male individual, and that individual having a soul, and Sheol is a place. It's not a person with a soul.
And that makes it the most powerful prophecy for our time.
I think
other than death and destruction of, you know, Syria and stuff like that, which is important. But this is the biggie.
This is the biggie. And unless you render it accurately from the Hebrew, you'll miss it. And perhaps that's the intent. Maybe you know, all of the Bibles that we have today, except the JPS, the Jewish Publication Society, with exception of the JPS Tanakh, are published by Christianity. They're all published by Christian publishers. And so I suspect that the Christian publishers know that this passage rendered correctly destroys their religion and therefore would destroy their businesses. Welcome back to Shattering Mess. Kirk, can you imagine being Shaul and reading this about yourself? And he obviously knew the prophecy. He knew that it spoke directly of him, and going ahead and going to war against the Creator God of the universe. Imagine doing that.
I have a real hard time with that. I understand if you had read it after the fact, after he had been possessed, then it would make more sense to me that he could do it. But he must have hated God the whole time.
Oh, of course.
Or didn't believe it when he read it the first time.
You know, but rabbis hate God.
I know.
They hate Yah. They're just like the Christians. They instead of actually changing his name, which is what the Christians did, they changed it to the Lord, which is Satan's name and title. And rabbinical Judaism, they created their own scriptures in the Talmud, so they wouldn't have to pay attention to his. And then they replaced his name, if you will, with Hashem, the name.
Mm-hmm.
And they love to use the Lord too, so
yeah.
You know, they don't like him either. So you know, I'm not surprised that there would be a rabbinical Jew that was willing to go to war knowingly against Yahweh. Now I am certain, absolutely certain, the way that Paul quotes this passage twice in his two most fundamental letters, that he was well aware of the passage before he was demon-possessed on the road to Damascus. And we don't know. Maybe he was demon-possessed, long before the road to Damascus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could well have...
Well, academic, you can still be of a frame of... You can be of a frame of mind and hate God enough that... or think he's powerless or against your intellect or something, if you got that kind of ego he has.
Yeah. Paul, he even says before, you know, the road to Damascus, that he was vicious, that he was murderous.
Yeah.
And so if you look at those who are influenced by Satan, they are vicious, they are murderous. Look at Muslims today. And then he also says that in Romans 7, that the Torah made him... actually sexually perverted.
Perverted.
You know, you look at Muslims and they're rapists. They trade in sex slaves. Paul, by his own admission, was sexually perverted. Claimed that the Torah made him sexually perverted. So there is every reason to suspect that Paul was demon-possessed in league with Satan well before his little adventure on the road to Damascus. What surprises me about Paul, and maybe it doesn't surprise me, but I want to at least mention this, is that twice in Acts, he tells us that the demonic voice, the voice that from the lightning, called him Shaul. Shaul, Shaul. And so he's admitting that his name is Shaul, and then he begins his first letter by saying that I, Paulos.
Mm-hmm.
So he changes his name as he addresses his first letter, but he acknowledges to Luke in Acts that the spirit that so harassed him on the road to Damascus called him by the name Shaul, when he knows that Shaul is the name of the individual that is specifically condemned in Chabaouk.
And you remember all the sermons about that when you were a Christian?
No. No.
Nobody brought that up at all, did they?
No. I would have to tell you that, quite honestly, I was so unaware of Chabaouk that when a friend of mine, when editing Questioning Paul, as we were trying to make the transition from the first version to the second version of Questioning Paul, found on a website called Jesus's Words Only. It's a website that exposes and condemns Paul from a unfortunately from a Christian perspective. It's kind of odd in this regard. Doesn't change Yahusha's name, and there's a lot of issues. But the fact of the matter is, they've got a lot of places in there where they juxtapose what Yahusha said and what, although they call him Jesus, and what Paul said to prove that Paul was a false prophet. So they do a nice job of proving that Paul was a false prophet. And on that website, evidently, there was a reference to the Paul claiming that he was not running in vain, and it tied it to this Chabaouk quote where it speaks that, he should be running. If you know about him, you should run. But I was unaware of Chabaouk as a prophet. I was unaware that it spoke of Paul prior to the second writing of the book.